Welcome back, listeners. On this episode, I spoke to costume designer Jennifer Johnson about her work on Blonde. Johnson is a BAFTA and CDG award nominee for I, Tonya. Blonde stars Ana de Armas, Adrian Brody, Bobby Cannavale, Xavier Samuel, and Julianne Nicholson.
But you had your premiere last night. How was that?
Oh, it was so special to be at the Chinese Theater where Marilyn's hands and footprints, shoe prints are. It felt incredibly special to be there and was exciting for me because I had not seen the movie on a big screen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. How was it? I'd only seen a link and I'd been on vacation in Sweden with my husband and saw a link in a little cottage. And so it wasn't quite the same experience as last night, but both times incredible.
Yeah. How was it seeing it for the first time though? Just like that big.
Oh, it's last night you mean?
Yeah.
You're always a little, as a designer or anyone that works on any crew member that works on the film, you're always a little afraid, you know, cause it's so big, the image. And so you're kind of like taking in a little more detail. I feel like this movie should be watched on the big screen. I love the format of it and it's so beautiful. The cinematography that Chase Irving did is incredible. And the details and the production design of Florencia Martin and the hair and makeup, you know, and costumes, I think deserves a big screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I definitely agree there. And I'm going to try and see it when it does come out in sort of its limited run. And
I think anyone who's a film fan, you know, first of all, I think Andrew Dominik is such an incredible director. And I think anyone who's like a real kind of cineast must go see this movie in the theater because it is, it's so fucking cool.
But so my first question for you, what was your familiarity with Marilyn Monroe before diving into this sort of deep dive?
Yeah, now I have a very intimate relationship with her. As a kid, I had unfettered access to television. I had a TV in my bedroom and cable and HBO as a child and was watching things that were not appropriate at all. I think I saw The Shining when I was like 8, which is terrifying. And so I had seen quite a few of her movies as a kid. And I have a distinct memory of Bus Stop, for instance, as a movie that I loved as a child. And, you know, it was the first time I'd seen her in a movie that was very serious. And she had been in, you know, I'd seen Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and that movie's fun, especially when you're a kid and it's dress up. But Bus Stop was the first time that I can remember where I thought, huh, this is a whole different depth of this actor that's fascinating. But I think as an American, and I think actually globally, maybe every country can say this, she belongs to all of us. We're so familiar with her. I mean, if you don't know who she is, like you've been sleeping, you know, you've been hiding on a deserted island, I think. And so it's hard to avoid her. And especially my mother's family, though not in the industry, they all are from Hollywood back through the Depression. So as a kid, I always spent a lot of time in Hollywood visiting my grandparents. And so we would always go down to Hollywood Boulevard and there would be a Marilyn, you know, and go to Universal Studios, there's another Marilyn. And then as you get older, you watch a drag performance of Marilyn. And, you know, there's all these iterations of Marilyn that outlive and supersede, like, you know, it's amazing. Like she never, you see, I met a teenager recently that had her image printed on their, you know, her face was on their t-shirt. And so it feels like every generation has their own version of Marilyn, whether that's Kim Kardashian or, you know, it's quite interesting how her star may never fade. You know, I think there's something so compelling about her.
Mm-hmm. And so why Blonde and why now?
You should ask Andrew that question.
I wish.
He tried to get it going for 10 years. And so it's really interesting to think about what would the movie have been like 10 years ago. You know, I think that today's viewer is so different. We are now, you know, in Me Too. I don't know if you call this post Me Too, because it's now just part of our culture and a big seismic shift in how people relate to one another. That would have been different 10 years ago. The conversation might have been different about what this movie meant to people, or what it, you know, what impact it had.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. We made it in 2019, and then the pandemic hit. So you would have, that question would have been, why 2019?
Yeah, no, for sure. And speaking of Andrew, what were your early conversations with him around this project?
So because Andrew had been on the project, he had been developing the project and looking for financing for so long that he had developed a huge amount of a huge document, PDF. I want to say it's like 800 pages. And yeah, that became our Bible for making the movie. I've worked with very visual directors before. Mike Mills is the person that I think of the most, like somebody, because he's also an artist and a graphic designer, coming to a project like very, you know, like detailed in their mood and research. But Andrew, because he'd been living with it for so long, he was so ready to make the movie. And so the initial conversations were sort of like, you know, kind of how to attack the movie, because we didn't have that much money. And, you know, we also needed to be economical while we were shooting. And I don't mean that with money, I meant with time. Well, time is money, right? So a lot of discussions were not only creative, but it also was like, you know, kind of like a military attack. Like, here we have it. He had done so much work. He was so ready to go. How does each head of department direct their teams in order to create the most efficiency? So that was a big part of it. But some of that efficiency would require, maybe things wouldn't have been as high quality. And so every department was really, really invested in having some kind of workaround where he would not know maybe how long something took. We always delivered it on time, but behind the scenes, we were putting a lot of extra effort into, especially with the film creations, because he would have on set the actual film, and then he would have the monitor live of Anna. Mm-hmm. And so we were always reminded, you know, of what had happened in the 50s and what was happening in 2019. And there was always this like unspoken reminder that this is what we are going for, this level, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so his guidance was really, he was really, really, it was very important to him that Anna and I have a great relationship, and I always have a good relationship with actors. And a lot of my time was spent with her. We had a tremendous amount of fittings, and they were very long and very arduous for her. And it was really kind of working out a lot of, you know, again, like thinking about time when you're on set, like, how can we get her dressed quickly? Do we want to put prosthetics on her body? You know, what does that mean for her arrival time on set? And sort of like, you know, will she be too hot? Does it feel like then she suddenly gets taken out of character because we've actually tried too hard? Like, we've been too accurate. So there were those moments where, you know, I made decisions to either simplify certain things or create ways to make Anna's day easier and make her more comfortable, so she could really dedicate herself to the role and not think about costumes. And I think the movie has a has a sense of naturalism that I feel proud of, because I think we did strip away some of those artifices that if you were doing like an exact match would have felt like very suffocating. And with that said, that's so funny, because then I look at the images side by side that I'm seeing on the internet and I'm like, it looks exact. But I think the intention we had was, let's, and then that was true, Andrew always said, like, don't get too bogged down, like, you know, let's just, you know, try to match it as best we can. But, you know, like I said, you were reminded of the expectation when you saw the original image sitting on the set. Mm-hmm. So
it was. Is that intimidating?
Terrifying. Absolutely horrifying, you know. And so it is really, really, really sad. I'm really loving all, like, so many people have been putting together these comparison images, and I'm very happy about it. Mm-hmm. It feels good, because there was a tremendous amount of psychotic energy put into this movie.
I love that. And so how do you tackle Norma Jean first, and then how do you tackle Marilyn?
I mean, for me, you know, and for Andrew and for Anna, Norma Jean is exceptionally important. There's the recreations, but at the end of the day, Norma Jean is the one, this is her inner psyche, right? This is her interior. This is her story. This is her mind. And so, as simple as those costumes are, that was really important to define. And that was important to Andrew. What is that uniform? And so we went through the images together, and he really highlighted some things that he liked. And those images happened to be in correlation with her working in the actor's studio and moving to New York and really redefining herself outside of the Hollywood factory that manufactured her, and finding the real Norma Jean. And so she does develop a uniform that is based on intellectuals, artists, you know, wearing black in the 1950s is a big statement. It doesn't mean anything now, but back then, if you weren't going to a funeral and you're wearing a black turtleneck, you would have been identified as somebody who was maybe part of intelligentsia or not part of the mainstream. And I think that she was very interested in reflecting her intelligence and showing, you know, herself to her fellow colleagues in the actor's studio or walking down the street as a serious actor. And I think if she had lived, it would have been so exciting to see this whole new chapter of her existence, because I think ultimately she is an incredible actor. She's funny and she's sad and she's incredible. She has so much depth. And which Anna transfers incredibly well. She's so great. So my job was to, you know, give her a few key pieces that did not distract from Anna's performance. It's really easy to do like a kind of fashion show of a movie, you know? Mm-hmm. And that is something that, you know, like Baz Luhrmann, who's an incredible director, does really well, but that's not what we're doing here. We're not showing off, right? We're kind of really, really trying to tell a story about and the interior life of Norma Jean. Mm-hmm. Or Marilyn Monroe. And so my goal always was to strip that down when I could. And even in her most fantastical recreation costumes, like how to meld the costumes into Anna so she could just effortlessly become Marilyn, you know. Not an easy task.
Yeah, I was about to ask, how does one meld like the iconic pink gown or just, I know, like, I mean, anything.
And you know, I think you can see it in some of the fittings, like before we really nailed it, like the dress can definitely wear her or any actor, right? Like the garment, the costume can become, you know, such a distraction that, and it is wearing the person. A lot of that is proportions. Like, you know, you sort of address it kind of architecturally. It's sort of when you're walking down the street and you look at a terrible apartment building and this beautiful, beautiful house had been torn down, you know, and this modern, I mean, modern architecture can be great, but it is a lot harder to pull off. And some of Marilyn's costumes are very minimalist in that same way. And so it's really about attention to detail with proportions and tailoring, and also how it moves with Anna, right? Like, I'm not dressing Marilyn, I'm dressing Anna de Armas as Marilyn or as Norma Jean. So always, I would always pay attention to Anna and her body and, you know, how it looked on her. And then that, I think by creating such attention to the actor's physical self, not only that, we paid a lot of attention in the workshop. There's a tremendous amount of handwork with all the costumes. So there's hours and hours and hours and hours of hand sewing that were happening at Western Costume and at Bill Hartgate and with our seamstress Lydia. And because there's, I feel like, so much hands on these garments of people that really cared about the project, that these costumes sort of like transferred all this energy. I mean, it sounds like really hippie, and I was born in Taos, but you know, like, there's some reason that sometimes I can't put my finger on, like, why does she feel natural in that pink dress? You know, why does it just work? Why does it not look silly? You know, because in real life we were trying to emulate Technicolor, and so we had to use a color pink that was so garish and ugly, and then in post they colored it so it would feel like Technicolor. And so in person it was like quite odd and bright, and she looked like a neon cotton candy, you know. But I think it is, like, there's so much love and tension with her wig that Jamie Lee did and her makeup that Tina did. And it just keeps, it is like a fine piece of architecture. Like, every little thing starts adding up and suddenly becomes one. And in that moment, then it's no longer a costume, it's a whole. You know, you have an actor, you have hair and makeup, costume, the set, and it's all kind of solidified into one energetic, you know, feel. I mean, it's hard to not talk about Andrew's movie in a sort of mystical way, because he is that way. And, you know, there was one day we shot at a lot of real locations that Marilyn actually lived in, which is, there's a whole nerdy side point that we could go into about all the incredible location work. But there was one house that we shot at that is with the playwright, and in real life, she lived there with Arthur Miller. And there was one day that Andrew was kind of summoning Marilyn, and he's like, "Are you here?" He was saying her name, and all of a sudden the mirror in the room jumped off, just fell off and shattered. And that shattered mirror is actually in the movie. But we definitely, I think, because we were in those locations so often, including where she died, we shot in that house, you could feel her spirit. You can't, none of us could deny it. Maybe it's wishful thinking, but there is an alchemy and a kinetic energy that I think happened in that project.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, because I wouldn't call this a biopic, and yeah, it's like a fantasy biopic. I don't know what the right term is for it. And so when you're talking about people sort of like coming back to, but you're like putting a real star who's a star in her own right into another star's body. It's trippy. And so I get this sort of like hippie-esque.
It's super meta and trippy. And last night was really trippy. So we're in the Chinese theater watching a premiere of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes within the movie. So that's a movie within a movie, right? So there's Blonde the movie, but then within that movie, there's an audience at the Chinese Theater watching Gentleman Prefers Blonde. And then I'm there watching the premiere. Anyway, that was really cool. But I think because that we were in fact in these actual locations, we did not technically shoot at the Chinese Theater, but we were in so many, you know, that the beginning of the movie when she's with her mother, that is the actual house that she lived in as a kid, you know. And when you walk outside, I think that's Sunset Gower Studios. It's that studio on Gower. That's all, that's not CG. Like, that's the studio. I mean, all of that is real. And that was, I think that energy exists for sure.
Mm-hmm. And is there a particular look that you're most proud of from this project? I know that's probably, it's like picking a favorite child, but is there one in particular?
I always say it's actually quite easy for me to answer. And I think it's not only because the dress was so hard to make, it's because it gets a lot of pornography moment. It gets a big pornography moment in the movie. I don't think I've ever worked on something that had so much dress porn. There's a slow-mo of the white dress, the pleated dress from 7 Year Itch that she wears when she stands over the subway grate and the wind blows the skirt up. And that is a very luxurious moment in the movie that Andrew really takes his time with Chase to follow her. And, you know, it's a 360 and you can see every detail from the underwear we made, the shoes that were made for her, and this pleated dress that is so iconic. And that dress exists on Hollywood Boulevard. It exists in drag performance. It exists so far beyond Maryland, that dress at Halloween parties. And all of those creations are a little wrong. And it was really hard to figure out what was wrong about them and try to get it right. And then I made some creative decisions which Andrew didn't know about, you know, because we were all working at that point, we're shooting and we're just all on fire and, you know, barely keeping our speed up or keeping up with his speed on set. So that I had a little more yardage added. So the skirt is so big that it just envelops her and she disappears in it. And it was kind of this unspoken thing. I'm not sure Andrew even knew that I had the dress made, you know, I just showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And we hadn't tested it. And we were at the Fox back lot where it was actually shot, the scene that ended up in the movie, in the original movie. And to see that for the first time, you know, and the extras are there playing the press guys and it's all happening. And I'm very proud of that because you can really soak it in when you watch the movie, the amount of work that was put into making that dress.
Yeah, no, it's magical. It's sort of just like, I don't know. I don't think there's really another word to describe it. I mean, there's just so many moments like that in this movie that, I mean, are so fantastical. And so, I don't know, present. Like you feel very present for, which is, I mean, yeah. I don't know. It's like,
you know, like it's not related at all, but it's like the tree of life. When you watch like Chivo, like shooting a tree or something, you're like that. I've never seen a tree. So you know, tree-like. And there's something about, and now our movie's so different, no comparison in its photography or anything, but there's something about the dress, you know, that is luxuriated in a way that you don't see in movies. We see that with nature photography and we see that in other ways. But I think that I really appreciate that moment because I think that the costumes are very important to the film and it's a good shout out.
Yeah, no, for sure. And our final few minutes, I mean, what do you hope that audiences take away from this particular project? And what do you take away from this project?
I hope, well, first of all, I feel like there's a lot of comments online with people that haven't seen the movie. And I think there's an ownership of Marilyn. You know, this is, like you said, this is not a biopic. It is a fictional version of Marilyn based on a Joyce Carol Oates book. It is her interior, but it also tells a very complex story of being a woman and being a woman in Hollywood and being a woman that did advocate for better pay and advocated for better things for herself in the face of abuse from all angles. And it is a very human story. And Marilyn ultimately is a person that we all can see parts of her in ourselves or our own experience. And I also think, you know, it's quite interesting, like if people are offended by the movie, I think that maybe they're offended by their own life. Like I think that abuse and, you know, and the subject of abortion, those are things that many people have gone through. And I think this is a very human story. And ultimately, Marilyn is an individual and she's an intelligent, beautiful person. And that's my own takeaway as well. Like that's what I got from working on this project is I have a lot of admiration for her as an artist, as an actor, and as a human.
Mm-hmm. And what did, and final question, what was the most important thing that you learned from her?
I think the humanity of her and the kindness of her and the intelligence of her shows in her acting. If you really, you know, if you're really like looking past the artifice, you can see it in her films, the depth. But I think that there is, I think the reason we're still talking about her is not just like she's so beautiful. You know, when you watch Seven, You're Itch and you're looking at her, all her angles, like she's so photographable, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just that. Something else about her that continually allows for all of us to keep talking about, and I think that is incredible. I think she has touched everyone in a way that is fascinating.
Yeah, no, it is fascinating when you were mentioning sort of like Kim Kardashian earlier and sort of the dress that she wore months ago. It's like, oh, is Kim Kardashian the next Marilyn? It's like, there's no way. But anyway.
No, there would be no, I don't know. It'd be impossible to ever recreate that because in the time of social media, there's nothing organic. It's very hard to be original. It's really hard to be punk rock. It's really hard to like truly be different. And I think for somebody like Marilyn Monroe to take it in her hands and say, you know what? This is what I'm going to be. I'm going to be an intellectual and this is how I'm going to, you know, she wasn't like looking at social media. It didn't exist, you know? And so all of her choices are really, it's really cool. Like times before social media, because it really is like genuine, you know. I think for all the artifice, I feel like she's such a genuine person, and I think this story of her life is so genuine and it's so real and honest, and it is nothing to be offended by. It's things that many of us or many loved ones have gone through, and I think that that's it's a heavy film, but it's beautiful.
Thank you all for listening. This episode was edited and produced by me, Jackson Vickery. Graphics were done by Dylan Michael, and the opening and closing theme were done by Sterling Gavinsky.